Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet and biographer Julia Coppice examines the role of intense personal experience in contemporary poetry, including her own recent work. Following Julia, the poet, memoirist and historical novelist Joanne Limburg examines the complex responsibilities of writing honestly about one's own life when this also requires writing about the lives of others. First up, here's Julia with A Wider Truth.
A Wider Truth, Poetry and the Personal. When American poet Sharon Olds' collection, Stag's Leap, won the 2013 T.S. Eliot Prize, the poetry in it was variously described as brave, fearless, blunt, and touchingly poignant. Elsewhere, her work has been labelled sensationalist, self-indulgent, solipsistic, even pornographic. Stag's Leap reconstructs the breakdown of a 30-year marriage in painstaking and sometimes intimate detail. Olds, now in her 70s, has always explored close family ties in her poetry. In her poem The Lifting from her 1992 collection The Father, the speaker's father lifts his hospital nightgown to show his daughter how much weight he has lost, leaving her to, quote, look at him, at his naked body, at the thick bud of his penis in all that dark hair, look at him. Out of context, the personal nature of such a detail feels voyeuristic, salacious even. Within the body of the poem, it brings even more vividly to life a lyric that is both moving and disarming. Olds has explained that she prefers not to claim the experiences she writes about as hers. Be that as it may, assumptions are made, and in the wake of those assumptions, questions are asked. Should the private details of an individual life really be the stuff of poetry? Certainly such subject matter seems to be well enough regarded by judges of literary prizes. The 2010 Costa Book Award went to Joe Shapcott's Of Mutability, based on the author's experience of breast cancer. Other books that have won the poetry category of the same award centre variously around the premature death of a wife, Christopher Reed's A Scattering, the suicide of a wife, Ted Hughes's Birthday Letters, an isolated journey through an adolescence tinged with madness, Salima Hill's Bunny, and, once again, the death of a wife, Douglas Dunn's Elegies. This last volume was the first poetry collection to win the overall prize, then called the Whitbread Prize, back in 1985. More recently, Seamus Heaney's Human Chain, which includes, for instance, a poem about the trip he made in an ambulance after he'd suffered a stroke, was the winner of the 2010 Forward Prize for Best Poetry Collection of the Year. Joe Shapcott was at pains at the time of her win to point out that the reader doesn't get an account of my experience with breast cancer. I'm not an autobiographical poet in that sense. I'm not someone chasing her own ambulance. Even if she were an autobiographical poet in that sense, art is very rarely a straight representation of the raw experience. Nevertheless, is it true is a question poets quickly get used to hearing, in classrooms, at poetry readings, even from friends. There's nothing very surprising about this. We humans are curious creatures. It was once put to me during an interview for Radio 4's Front Row. In particular, the interviewer wanted to know if the story had ended for me in real life exactly as I had related it in the poem. Caught off guard, I fumbled and fudged my answer. Even now, I'm not quite sure how to respond, or indeed whether I'd want to. Coleridge said that, quote, poetry relies for its power upon truthfulness. Thankfully, there are different kinds of truth. The ancient Greek word for truth was aletheia. Its literal meaning is the state of not being hidden, and hence disclosure. The word carries a strong implication that in order to be unhidden, the object has emerged from a state of concealment. In other words, a transformation has taken place, just as it does when we read or write a strong lyric poem. It seems to me that this version is close to what is meant today by what is known as poetic truth. Coleridge wasn't talking about documentable truth, but about a kind of revelation about Aletheia, a truth that unfolds in real time as the poem itself unfolds. Robert Frost described the process vividly when he likened a poem to a piece of ice on a hot stove that must ride on its own melting. That same transformation, that same melting process, is reenacted whenever the poem is read, which is why a good poem induces a feeling of recognition in the reader. As Auden said, "We hope that someone reading it will say, 'Of course, I knew that all the time, but never realised it before.'" Often it only feels like recognition. What really happens is that the poem triggers a new insight in the reader, an insight that is often perceived more clearly by the subconscious than the conscious mind, and so much the better. Either way, its apprehension helps us to orient ourselves within the chaotic landscape of our own lives. That is not to say that all poems reveal their truths by degrees, accumulating significance line by line as we read on to the end. There are many types and many shapes of poem. Some are formed of lines of equal weight and import, built like rectangles. Others end on an expansive couplet, broadening at the base like triangles. Others again are like balls of crumpled paper that go on opening in the mind long after they've been read. Some are expressly political, and some appear to stem from private experience. To return to the idea of documentable truth, what sparked the question in the case of my radio interview was a piece called Ghost, a sequence of poems in my most recent book that follows a cycle of IVF treatment. The book's dust jacket makes it clear that I had based the poems on experience. It would be difficult to write about such a subject if I had not. But as I explained to the interviewer, the woman in the ghost sequence isn't exactly me. It occurs to me now that she is rather unlike me. For one thing, she is a lot braver than I am. The sequence, then, is essentially fictional. But the two smallest humans of the book's title are real enough. There was an unearthly moment during my own experience of IVF when the embryologist walked into the treatment room with my two best embryos attached to the end of a pipette. In she walked in a little scrub cap and tunic, looking more like a bakery worker than someone who was carrying in her latex-gloved hands the smallest human beings possible. Moments later, those same beings were transferred to my womb to do their best. One of the biggest decisions I had to make when writing Ghost was how the narrative would end. Would the woman fall pregnant or not? And how would she react? As I've suggested, the decision was never really mine to make. I had to trust the poem to take its own course, to ride on its own melting. By the end of the sequence, though the treatment fails, the patient remains undeterred. Her hope is bruised, but, crucially, unbroken. And in the final poem, she addresses her unborn child directly. Chiel, adrift in the deeps of the future. Twy ripe, yet to be son or daughter. And she ends by making a pledge to her future child. I give myself over, shell and shelter, child, my own. By and by, with the push of the wash, I'll usher you in. I've said that the sequence is fictional, and I believe that should be taken as read. Every poem, even one based on the writer's own life, is a fiction, because every poem has gone through a shaping process. It has been chipped and chiselled and moulded into something meaningful. The word fiction comes from the Latin fictio, a fashioning, and from the verb fingere, to shape, fashion or form, and originally to knead or form out of clay. The clay may come from 100 different sources: the poet's own life, a newspaper article, an image, a phrase, a memory, or purely from imagination. More often than not, though, it comes from a mixture, a blending of fact and non-fact. It really makes very little odds. What matters is what the author does with the clay. The assumption that a poet is recounting details of their own life tends only to be made about first-person lyrics, short poems spoken by an unidentified I. But in fact, a dramatic monologue, also spoken in the first person, but in the voice of an identifiable named character, may have just as deep a personal resonance for the author. It will certainly contain something of them. The situations I describe in my own dramatic monologues often correspond with situations I've lived through and with the emotions I've experienced as a result. To take an example from my last book, when the ill-fated hero from the myth of Hero and Leander describes the long wait for her lover, the agony of both wanting and not wanting him to swim to her across the Hellespont because of the danger he'll face if he does, and the horrible stretching of time that results, her speech is, in a sense, an act of ventriloquism. It makes no difference to the poem, but it happens that I once waited for a person, now my husband, on a night similarly fraught with danger. You might even say it is my anxiety that Hero experiences when she talks of an awful inblown wind that tugged at my mind till it swayed and leaned and sprang back straight like a birch tree shifting in the wind's work of lowering and lifting. C.S. Lewis's assertion that we read to know we are not alone might equally apply to the writing process, which often starts from a sort of fear of aloneness, a yearning to know that we are part of something larger than ourselves. Alice Oswald has described the moment when, age 8, after a long night of fear, she wrote a poem to celebrate the fact that the night was finally over. That was the moment, she says, that she made up her mind to become a poet. Just over a century earlier, on the other side of the Atlantic, Emily Dickinson wrote to her literary mentor, Thomas Higginson, "I had a terror since September I could tell to no one, and so I sing, because I am afraid." In the end, it is the striving for communication and for connectedness that stops a poem, however personal it may seem, from becoming a solipsism. As Sharon Olds put it in conversation with The Guardian back in 2008, once a poem is written, it doesn't feel personal. It feels like art, a made thing. The I in it, not myself anymore, but, I'd hope, some pronoun that a reader or hearer could slip into.
That was Julia Copus. You can find out more about Julia on the RLF website. Next, here's Joanne Lindberg with Writing the Lives of Others.
When I was in my early 20s, I spent 3 years in therapy with a Freudian analyst. The rules of engagement were clear enough. My job as patient was to reveal as much as possible about myself to the analyst. Her job was to listen, while revealing nothing back. For 3 years, all I knew about her, apart from her name and her profession, was what I saw and heard. She was a woman. She was in her 40s, probably, and from North America, somewhere. This made me very uncomfortable. It seemed to me that there was a massive power differential between us, and that it was very much in her favour. I would dream in the best Freudian style of looking behind her chair or going through her handbag. During the time I was seeing her, I even took an MA in psychoanalytic studies, partly out of genuine interest, but also because the only way I could cope with my powerlessness was by convincing myself that one day I would sit in her chair, that being a patient was just a state I had to pass through in order to become a therapist. Before starting the MA, I worked as a researcher for a financial publisher. We shared a building with Routledge. They kept samples of their books on display in the lobby. They published academic books, philosophy, literary theory, psychoanalysis. One day I caught sight of a familiar name on one of the spines. It was my therapist. She had written a book about dreams. I nearly jumped out of my skin. This was a book by someone who listened to other people's dreams, including mine. I was very much afraid that there might be bits of me in there, appropriated for someone else's use, described in her terms and presented to her readers for judgment. We got a whole session out of that. When I think about it today, what strikes me, apart from my 20-something egoism, is that it doesn't seem to have occurred to me that if she were going to put material from our sessions into a book, anonymised obviously, that she might have thought to ask my permission, or at the very least to warn me. I should think she would have done. I hope so anyway. Although I never made it into the therapist's own chair, which is probably just as well, I did come to write books, and in doing so I, in my turn, became somebody who gets to appropriate bits of other people for my own use, describe them in my terms, and present them to my readers for judgment. Particularly so because I'm the sort of writer who draws on her own life and doesn't even have a decency to fictionalise it. I started out writing mostly autobiographical poetry and went on to publish a prose memoir about my experiences of OCD, anxiety and depression. I'd like to think that I haven't done any of this for cynical reasons. I write the sort of work I'd like to read, and I write in good faith, but all the same, when people ask me what it is I do, and I have to tell them, I often wish I could tell them something else. It isn't just that in publishing work about myself I could justly be accused of attention-seeking, though heaven knows that's bad enough. It's also that, in writing about my own life, I am unavoidably drawing on experiences that I've shared with other people. I am, as I said, appropriating bits of their lives, bits of them, for my own purposes. I was very keen to write the memoir, but I also wanted to do right by other people, so I did all I could to minimise possible harm. I withheld or changed names. I changed other details where necessary. I obtained explicit permission whenever I could. It also helped that I had an antagonist, which was a mental illness rather than a person, because I didn't want to write bad things about other people. It didn't seem fair to expose them to judgment in that way. So whenever I had to describe a situation where I'd been in conflict with someone, I made it sound as much my fault as I possibly could. I didn't want to expose my family, especially not my mother and brother, who were both still alive at the time. So I did my best to stop the resulting gaps in the narrative by stuffing them with ever more lurid details about my own neuroses. I was getting paid for this. They weren't. So fair enough. It was a tricky balancing act. All the more tricky because, at the time of writing, while I was so conscientiously suppressing the family narrative in my book, that same narrative was intruding further and further into my life. Put briefly, about halfway through the writing, my brother and my mother fell out. I heard both versions. I tried not to take sides. I tried to help them reconcile. I failed miserably. And then, about three quarters of the way through the writing, and for reasons that are still far from clear to those of us left, my brother took his own life. 2 years later, my mother also died. If a living person feels misrepresented by a writer, they can seek redress, either legally or by publishing their own version of events. The internet has the potential to restore some narrative power to those whose stories are told by others, and I think this is a very good thing. The living have rights that can be breached, and feelings that can be hurt. It seems only fair that we should, each of us, have a controlling interest in our own stories while we're living them, and, as I found in the lobby of the Routledge building, the thought that they might have been told without our permission is something that makes us very unhappy. Now, my mother and brother both believed, as I do, that when you die, that's it. The dead don't have any feelings to hurt, and they lack the capacity to either give or withhold permission. With my father gone too, and my mother's flat emptied, most of the remaining components of my family's story, the photographs, the documents, whatever memories we shared, are now in my sole possession, which means I have, potentially, complete control over the very narrative I once felt compelled to suppress. There's nothing lurid or extreme in my family's story, but all the same, if I were to write it, I could easily wind up saying things that might well have hurt them when they were alive, and even if I didn't do that, I would still be putting aspects of their private lives on show without their permission. I love my family, and I want to protect them for their sakes, but I want to tell part of their story for mine. When I was in my 20s, I was horrified by the thought that someone else might be exercising power over my story. In my 30s, I took the fullest possible control over that story by shaping it into a book and publishing it. Readers and reviewers then took the book as source material for their own versions of me. The reviewers got to publish theirs, and they weren't always friendly. Photographers posed me in unnatural ways. A journalist at one of my readings described me as nervous-looking and mousy-haired. I had very little control over how I was represented, but I accepted that. I couldn't say I hadn't asked for it. But I do know exactly what it means to put quite so much intimate stuff into the public arena, and I'm not sure I want to subject my family to that. They haven't asked for it. So while I will spend part of my 40s writing our shared story, because I need to, I may never publish it. After I'm done, I'll have to make a judgment about whether the good in what I've written outweighs the possible harm. Power means responsibility. It's not really so comfortable in that other chair.
That was Joanne Lindberg. You can find out more about Joanne on her website at www.joannelindberg.net. That's Lindberg spelled B-U-R-G. And that concludes episode 13, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 14, we have the final episode in our three-part genre swap series. In this episode, we catch up with Annie Caulfield and Emma Darwin several months later to find out how their writing projects have gone. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.